the basic argument that we made last time on contracts is that you want to figure out how to maximize the size of the pie, because the bigger the pie, the larger the slices both parts can have. And even if a particular change benefits the other side at a cost to you, you can offer that change at a price and thus make both of you better off. And how do you increase the size of the pie? From an economist's standpoint, it's by giving parties more nearly the right incentives, that each party to a contract is making decisions, and you want them to make the decisions that maximize the size of the pie, and you're trying to figure out how to do so. And the sort of simple rule is that you want to make it in my interest to make any decision for which the total benefit to both of us is larger than the total cost, and if you can't make it in my interest in terms of my payoff to do it, you can do it maybe by having a contractual term by which I agree to make that decision, assuming we know what it is. And trying to do that faces a couple of problems. One of them is that both the parties may not all know the relevant things. I, as the buyer, may not be able to tell if the windows are of good quality or if they were bought at the best price. I can't observe everything, so that even if you agree to work 10 hours a day, I may not know if you're doing it, and I can't control all of the things I can observe. So those are sort of a very general case. And we ran that through a number of applications: repairing copying machines, contracting for a nightclub musician, and building a gym. And basically in each case, we're looking at the incentives for both parties. How do we make it in the repair company's interest to do a good job repairing at minimum cost? How do we make it in the owner's interest to minimize the cost associated with repair by how they use the machine, what machines they buy, and so forth? And similarly, for a nightclub musician, we're trying to set up contractual terms that give the right incentives, that don't offer too many opportunities to cheat, that can be observed, and that deal with the desire of both parties to hold down various risks. And we then, building a gym involved similar issues. Right. Let's now go on to the case of principal agent contracts, which cover a whole lot of things. In a way, construction contracts are principal agent contracts, since the contractor is acting as an agent of the home buyer. Employment contracts are principal agent contracts. You as a lawyer are going to be the agent of your client. You might argue that the president is the voter's agent, although that's getting a little bit more abstract, since I individually don't get to fire him or hire him. I only get a very small voice in that. And then there are basically, the book argues, I think it's a reasonable way of looking at it, three approaches to how you structure such contracts, how you structure the incentives. One of them is you pay by performance. The agent is a salesman, I'm a dealer, and he gets $1,000 each time he sells a car. Maybe he gets more if he sells the car at a higher price. We could, after all, there's bargaining involved, or if he sells it with financing terms that we make money at, or whatever the terms are. You're a lawyer. Well, one way of paying you is a contingency fee, where you get paid if you win the case, and you don't get paid if you don't win the case. And you can also pay for input. That's a very, very common arrangement. You hire somebody to spend a certain number of hours doing a job, and you pay him by the hour. You, as a lawyer, may get paid by the billable hours. When I very rarely do consulting work, I'm paid by the hours. And the people who pay me are surprisingly willing to believe my count of the number of hours, given that they are not usually in a position to observe it. And finally, you can use a fixed fee contract. I, in fact, just did that not very long ago. We have a quite old and very nice big oak dining room table, which was very wobbly in a number of different dimensions, not to mention its surface being less elegant than it was when I refinished it 30 years ago. And I found somebody with a good reputation doing furniture repair, and he said, "This is how many dollars I'll pay. I'll charge to fix your table." And he fixed everything except one thing for which he didn't have the part. The part is now in, and if I can just find his card, I can call him up, and presumably he'll come in and install it. And so fixed fee contracts have advantages and disadvantages. We'll be seeing the advantages of all of these. And, of course, real contracts very often have some combination of those, so that Even the car salesman probably, I suspect, has a salary as well as a bonus. So if he sells zero cars, he gets paid at least for a while until they decide to fire him. And the law firm may be entirely on contingency. It may be some combination of contingency and a fixed fee or a per hour or all three of those. You often have a salary with bonuses. I'm thinking of a story my son told me when he was working at Google, that there had been some team that had made some important breakthrough and Google made lots of money out of it, and Google gave the team like $1 million or so as an optional bonus to make other teams want to do similar things. Incidentally, it's not really relevant to what we're doing, but in this particular environment, one issue that employers have to think about is the problem of making their employees so rich they'll no longer bother to work for them. I actually know somebody who, I think he was the chief engineer for Intel a long time ago. Intel was much smaller. And they were having problems with malfunctions in their microcomputers. And he was the one who realized that it was, I think, cosmic rays, but in any case, radiation of some sort, that they finally made things small enough so that the random effect from hitting this could cause a malfunction. They paid him what must have been a very large bonus. I judge that because he quit and has been basically spending, as far as I know, spending his time motorcycling and thinking up interesting ideas about encryption and related stuff. He was one of the original cypherpunks, for those who are familiar with that online group of people, ever since. And similarly, Google, as far as I can tell, is following a strategy of making it more fun to be at Google than not to be at Google, with the result that even though their brightest people are likely to be millionaires by now, hopefully at least some of them still stay. But in any case, and of course there's a certain sense in which what is nominally a fixed fee may actually be a bonus, if you think about the case where I'm paid a certain amount per year, but I and my employer both know that if I do really well this year, I'm likely to get a raise next year. Or flipping that, if you think about car insurance, you are paying a fixed amount independent of how much of whether you have an accident, but next year when you want to renew your insurance policy, if they've concluded you're a worse risk than they thought you were, it may turn out you're going to be paying a higher rate. So there are lots and lots in practice of combinations of these things. So the problem is incentives. How do we make it in the interest of the agent to do what the principal wants? So what does the principal want in a lawsuit? Someone's smashed into your car. What is your objective? Yeah?
Fix your car.
What? Is that your objective? Does that fully describe what you want to do? So the lawyer says, all right, I'm charging you by the billable hours, and I'm charging you a price which is 10% more than I usually get, so I can assure you I'm going to work lots and lots of hours, and by God, you're going to get paid for your car. End of the year, we're going to get $40,000 damages for your car, and my bill will be only $60,000. Is really what you want to get paid for your car? What do you want?
Lost time.
Those are all things that go into how much money you ask for, but I'm asking, how do you judge when it's all over? The lawyer's done a certain amount of work at certain costs, gotten you a certain chance of winning some amount of money. What is your objective? What do you want? Is it a win if you win your case and pay more to the lawyer than the damage judgment? So what?
Unless you're like really spiteful.
Yeah, but generally it's not.
Yeah.
So what are you interested in?
Being put back in the position you were in
prior to. Well, I'd much rather be in a better position. I'd rather get halfway there than nothing. It seems to me that I want to know what your maximand is. What is the thing that you are trying to, on net, get? What? Make money, and your money, and the money you make from the lawsuit consists of what? There's a plus and a minus. What's the plus?
Your winnings.
The plus is the damages awarded to you, and what's the minus?
Your time,
whatever the costs are to you of that suit. So from your standpoint as the individual plaintiff, it isn't the way you want is to win the suit, it's the way you want is to maximize expected return from the suit net of costs to you of winning it. All right? And if you think about it in terms of you and the attorney together, if we think in terms of maximizing the size of the pie, then you can just say you want to maximize expected return net of all costs. All right? So that means that one of the problems, if you say, I'm doing it, one of the issues you want to think about is whether you are giving the attorney an incentive to spend either too little or too much time on the case. All right, you could imagine a case. Suppose we say to the attorney that if you you can think of lots of different forms, but if the attorney has very little incentive, then the problem is that you will save money on the attorney's effort, but you will lose it on losing your case. If the attorney has too much incentive, then you may push the chance of winning the case from 90% to 100%, but you may pay much more than that increase is worth. All right, does that make sense? All right, so it's not in the... Yeah?
Like there are risk-averse people. Are there individuals who would always go ahead and go with a trial or with the extreme, despite the fact that they might be in a loss?
You're saying there might be a risk-preferring person.
Right, yeah, risk-preferring.
There might be. I think that's much less common, especially because it's pretty cheap to generate risk in Las Vegas. That is, there's a house cut, but not a very large house cut. So if you're a risk preferrer, you might be happy with something where you were taking a 50% chance of $100,000 instead of a certainty of $51,000. But you're not likely to take a 50% chance of $100,000 instead of a certainty of $60,000, because if you took the certainty of $60,000, you could go to Vegas and convert it to more than a 50% chance of more than $100,000.
The only reason I ask is because there are certain plaintiffs who don't care about monetary gain; they just want to get justice, or they want to get their own.
That could be, and that could be either of two different things. It could be a non-monetary payoff to them. It could also be a monetary payoff in the longer term, where they say, if we make it clear that we will fight these cases to the bitter end, the next guy either won't do what this one did to us, or will settle easily. Right? It's not easy to tell, because of course the person who wants to establish the reputation may put it in terms of justice, whatever the cost, just so people will believe that they better give in to what he wants. And that's going to be hard to tell. But you know, sure there could be. And in any particular case, if you're an attorney, you're going to have to figure out what the objectives of you and your client are, obviously. No, I think a lot of this analysis looks at monetary objectives just because it's easier to, you know, write them down and put numbers on them, not because that's the only thing that exists, clearly isn't. All right. So if you think about a performance-based contract, one where the attorney gets some percentage of the return, then the problem is that if the reward is, suppose the attorney gets 50% of the payout, and now the attorney says, well, if we hire, imagine a case where the attorney pays all of the costs, but then gets contingency fee, gets 50% of the payout, say. And the attorney says, well, an extra expert is going to cost us $5,000. It's going to increase our chance of winning by enough so that our expected return will go up by 7,000. Should I hire the expert? You're getting a figure on a 50% contingency fee. The answer is no. I should, in terms of the joint interest of me and my client, but in terms of my own interest, the contract already being signed, I'm only getting 50%, so therefore I shouldn't. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right. It's a standard kind of insurance problem. You get the same problem. From the standpoint of giving the attorney the right incentive to decide when to hire experts, what percentage of the return should the attorney get?
Whatever money the cost of the individual.
I'm assuming that we're doing it just as all the attorneys, the only variable in what the attorney gets paid is how much damages we collect from the defendant. The attorney is paying for the expert. We get a further issue if we can have costs paid by somebody else. But consider the case where the inputs, where what the attorney gets to charge doesn't depend on the inputs, including the expert, only depends on the output, performance-based. So the attorney gets X percentage of whatever money we get out of the defendants. What should X be in order that the attorney will always make the right decision about whether to hire the expert?
Well, it reimburses the costs.
That's a separate. That isn't a performance-based contract. I'm looking just at performance-based contract. So I'm considering. We could also have an input-based contract, but let's just consider the case where the contract is the attorney bears all of the costs and the attorney gets some percentage of the money collected. And now the question is, what should that percentage be in order that the attorney will always have an incentive to make the right decision for the two-party, for the attorney and client, in terms of when to hire an expert? It's 50% work. In general. In the general case, will 50% mean each case, the attorney is considering bearing some cost, such as hiring an expert. It gets some return and increased payoff. If the attorney collects 50% of the payoff, will the attorney have an incentive to pay the extra cost any time it more than pays for itself in terms of total increased payoff? Yes, no? The more likely he is, suppose the percentage was 200%. That's not weird how he could do it. Yeah. Would that get the right decision in general?
Not for the client.
From the standpoint of the two of them together, would it get the right decision?
No.
Because?
Because the client is losing out on his
gain. That isn't the question. I'm interested in summed gains to the two parties. We can worry later about how we make the budget balance.
The attorney's gaining at the expense of the client, though, right? Is 200% by hiring this person?
If it's 50, but the question isn't whether he's gaining the expense of the client. The question is, does he have an incentive to hire the expert when it's worth hiring him and not hiring him when it isn't worth hiring him? With 50%, what's the problem? If the attorney gets 50% of the returns from the litigation, the gross returns, when will he not hire the expert when he should?
When the payoff of the expert is slightly under twice.
When the payoff of the expert is less than twice the cost of the expert. But more than the cost, and therefore he should. Suppose that we somehow had a contract where the attorney got 200% of the returns. All right? Now, when will he make the wrong decision about hiring the expert? That's right. So if it was 200%, now even if the expert cost $10,000 and only produced a $7,000 benefit, it would pay him to do it. All right. So therefore, what is the percentage at which the attorney would have the right incentive? What?
At
100%, exactly. So that if you look at it just from that standpoint, if you're trying to motivate the agent. Just by saying, what is the agent's incentive in terms of his performance-based return? Then you would want to give the agent the full value of whatever he's producing. All right. Now, for a moment, that's not impossible. It sounds crazy, but that's because you're only considering... Let me put it differently. Suppose we wanted to structure our legal system that way. What have I left out? Your car has just been smashed into by somebody, and you go hunting for an attorney. And the attorney says, well, you know, the way we do things nowadays is that any money we recover, I get. You say, well, that's just fine. But, of course, I'm the one who controls the case. I'm the one who's the victim. I will sell you the case for $50,000. All right? It is now the case that any money you recover, you get. You now have the full incentive. Anything that increases recovery by $10,000, you're willing to pay up to $10,000 to get. I've been reimbursed by you. You are now taking all the risk, of course. But there's nothing impossible about doing it in that way. It's just sort of a negative fixed price plus a percentage. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but then cases that are borderline, are never going to be picked up.
What do you mean?
Up for very, very little.
Of course. But cases which are borderline now are likely not to get litigated. Yeah. Right? That would just be a different way of rewarding attorneys, one which is not legal under, usually not legal under under current circumstances. Under current circumstances, if you have a tort case, you can sell part of it to your attorney. We call that a contingency fee. You can sell all of it to the defendant. We call that an out-of-court settlement. And you can sometimes transfer it to your insurance company. We call that subrogation. All right? But you can't freely sell it. There have been legal systems where you could. And there's something to be said for that, because after all, you as the tort victim know very little, little about the value of your case or how to pursue it. So if you set up an auction and say, what law firm will bid me the highest price for this case, you ought to get something close to the value. But in any case, that's sort of a digression, although I think it's an interesting digression. The real point I'm making is if you look at sort of several different dimensions of the contract, on one dimension, you'd like 100% to go to the agent, because that would give the agent the full incentive to do anything, whether it's his own time or the expert, that would do it. Now, you can solve some of the problem, as various of you suggested, by saying, well, we can look at how much he spent on the expert, and he gets to pass that on to the principal. But we can't look very easily at how hard he worked on the case in many principal agent cases. So therefore, where the costs of the agent are hard to observe, it now makes sense to try to motivate him by output results. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, let me keep going, and we can come back to this maybe. But there's the obvious problem with the 100% solution, especially if you've got more than one agent, if you think about employees, is going to be that the amount you're paying adds up to more than the total income. But in principle, you could solve that by having a negative fixed payment by the agent. There's a fixed payment by the agent, a negative payment to the agent. In which case, the agent is basically saying, in exchange for my getting 100% of the return, I'll pay you some fixed amount of money. So the problems with performance-based contracts are that the optimal reward to the agent is 100% of the benefit from his actions. That gives him the right incentives. What are the problems? Consider a store whose profit depends on 10 different employees. The logic of this says you want to give each of them 100%. That's going to add up to a whole lot more than total profit. Right? Because after all, it's not as if your total profit is the sum of the profit he made plus the profit he made plus the profit he made. They aren't separable. At least in many cases, they aren't separable. Sometimes they are. If he didn't manufacture the good, you're making no profit. If he manufactured it and he didn't sell it, you're making no profit either. So each of them, in a certain sense, is contributing 100%, and therefore, if you try to fully reward them, you're going to be paying out twice your money. Logically, it's not impossible, because you could imagine a system, though it's not one that I'm familiar with. Well, I wonder if there are any real-world examples. What I'm thinking of is something where employees all pay to be employees and then receive a performance-based payment, which on average is what they paid in plus their salary, as it were. All right, that's what you would get if it was important enough to... I think there are cases, I'm not sure, but I have a feeling that in some restaurants where the waiters get really big tips and sort of very elite restaurants, that waiters may in fact pay for the job. I'm not sure if that's right, but I have a feeling that's right.
It's kind of like buying a stall in the mall, though. You pay a certain rent, and then you're just hoping that on average the foot traffic, wherever it comes
yeah,
through,
right. That's right. That's in a sense a similar case.
Yeah,
So it's not impossible. But why in practice would it be very hard for a firm to hire workers on terms? Suppose the firm says to them, look, here's our experience from the past. Our contingency-based payment is going to give you $900,000. Your normal market value is $50,000. So the deal is that you pay us $850,000, and then you get the contingency-based payment according to how you do, which on average will give you $900,000 back. Why are we going to have a hard time finding employees on those terms?
People on the
money line
around, plus the risk
averse. The other is also true, but in particular, you're putting huge amounts of risks on your employees. All right, they go bankrupt if things go a little bit worse than usual. They're very rich if things go better than usual. So that suggests that what we have here is a tension between the optimal incentive for getting them to make the right actions and the optimal division of risk. And that's going to be sort of one of the problems in all of these contract things, is that you're simultaneously trying to give the agent the right incentives, to some extent the principal the right incentives, where he makes choices, and to get the right distribution of risk, and that isn't always an easy thing to do. So a further present problem, one problem is that there are costs in risk division, kind of costs to the rule that everybody gets 100%, which gives the right incentives. But a further problem is, how do we measure output? So that the president of a publicly traded company, the company's profits go up or down, but we don't know how much of that is his work. All right. And we could say, well, if they go up $1 million, he gets $1 million. If they go down $1 million, he pays us $1 million, but he's not going to take that gamble. Notice that one reason why you might decentralize firms is to make it at least easier to say what his production. So that if GM consists of six divisions, we can at least say if the Buick division made a lot of money, that's not due to the efforts of Chrysler? Chrysler is or isn't a GM? Chrysler's not GM, is it? No, that was one of the other ones. Whatever another, the Cadillac division. All right. So if you divide it, you can more nearly separate out the returns of different people. Similarly, if you think about a law firm, one of the things law firms try to do is to say, we're going to reward you by output, but your output is your clients, not his clients, he being another partner in the firm. And, of course, we again have the risk aversion problem, which means that maybe what we say is you get half the return from your clients, the other half is divided among all the partners. That's a way of insuring at the cost of giving you a lower incentive to drum up business or to keep your business happy. Question? All right, here is a case which just occurred to me today when I was thinking about this as an interesting puzzle to which I have an imperfect solution. Have any of you ever bought a house? You will, probably. This might be a good time to buy a house, right? In my experience, if you go to a real estate agent, one of the first questions the real estate agent asks you is, how much can you afford to pay for a house? Why does she ask that question, and should you answer it truthfully? Anybody know why she's asking that question? That's one way of putting it. But the critical fact is that the real estate agent is normally paid a percentage of the sales price of the house. If the contract is, and you don't actually normally get to negotiate this one, if the contract is she gets a percentage of the sales price of the house, what form of output is she trying to maximize?
It's the return over price paid
for the house. For you in particular, she's trying to maximize the price paid for the house. That's right. What would you like her to maximize? It's the more difficult question. What?
Value for price?
Yeah, value for price. That's a good way of putting it. The way I would have put it is your surplus from buying it, which means the difference between the highest price you would pay and the price you actually pay. So I might say, well, look, I could afford a $500,000 house. But if you can find me an almost as good house that's $400,000, that's a much better deal. Right? So if you truthfully tell her what's the highest price house you'll buy, she then has an incentive to only look at houses at that price range, and she's going to want to then sell you. It's true, among those houses she'll want to find one you like so you'll buy it, but she has no incentive to look for houses significantly below that price range, even if they would be better deals for you. All right. So if what you want is to maximize the difference between the value of the house to you and the cost, how might you, suppose we didn't have to worry with whatever the industry regulations are. Suppose you're just sitting out with a blank sheet and here's the realtor and you want to draw up a contract. That's what this chapter is about. How might you want to, it's going to be a output-based contract. What's the measure of output you're going to want? How do you do that? Anybody? You've told us what you want to maximize.
You can just give her a percentage of the money that she saves for you.
Saves, measures, how do you, what do you mean by the money she saves?
Well, you're saying you had a, you say you have a 500,000 ceiling, the 400,000 house is just as good, you know what I'm saying? So you're
well, except that not all $400,000 houses are equally good.
Yeah, exactly, but if you're unwilling to buy it, but it, well, I'm not going to buy this for that much money. It's not value. Because value, for the person, you said you like older houses, blah, blah, blah. It could be quite hard to measure. But you're saying, well, I would be willing to pay this much.
Ah, that's...
It would save me a lot of money.
That's the step. That is the contract that I want. And there are problems with this, but this is just, was just occurring to me today as an interesting innovation. Is that each house she shows me, I tell her what's the truthfully, what's the highest price I'd pay for it. Her commission is a percentage of the difference between that and what I get it for if I buy it. So she both has an incentive to help me get the price down as low as I can, whereas under the current system, she's got some incentive to encourage me not to bargain it down, because then she'll get a bigger commission. And she has an incentive in looking for houses to find the house that for which the difference between value to me and price is maximized. Does that make sense to people?
Can you explain that again?
Sure. My guess is you can't do this under current institutional arrangements, but putting that aside, I never worry much about those things. They aren't interesting. That the contract I offer the realtor goes as follows. Each house that you give me and that you show me, once I've got enough information, I will tell you what's the highest price I would pay if I had to buy that house. You will then decide which house you want to bid on. And try to get a, and you and I together will see if we can buy that house. Your reward will be 10% of the difference between what I said that was the highest price I'd pay and what we actually get it for. All right?
Well, it doesn't seem like to put the realtor in a bad spot there, because they probably want to have the incentive of getting people to put their houses up for sale for them, or something like that.
Assuming here that the realtor is the buyer's agent. I agree. There's a complication with the fact that realtors act for both buyers and sellers. But there are lots of cases where you've got realtors who, in a particular case, are acting for the buyer or are acting for the seller. So I'm imagining a realtor who's just acting for the buyer. And there's a list of multi-listing houses that are up for sale, and that realtor uses her expertise on neighborhoods and houses and such to find one for you.
Doesn't the realtor also have the incentive to just sell a house? Doesn't her reputation also play into it? I would guess the realtor, much like an attorney or any other person, would be like a salesman. The more they close, the better they're...
It's also true that in this case, the realtor has got costs. All right, because the realtor's got to spend some time selling houses. But what does that mean? The realtor is then trying to maximize some percentage of your gain minus her cost. And again, since the percentage is not 100%, there will be cases where she doesn't keep searching and should, because it would cost her $1,000 worth of time, which would give you a $2,000 benefit, but she only gets $200. So one imperfection in this is that she has an incentive to search for too short a time because only part of the benefit from additional search is going to her. The second problem which occurs to me is that you have an incentive to lie about what the house is worth to you. Depending how high the commission percentage is, on the one hand, you don't want to lie too much because you want to get the right house. But on the other hand, if the house is really worth $400,000 and you say it's worth $380,000, if you get that house, you're going to save $2,000 because you've just cut her commission by $2,000. So there is a problem with this system, but I think it is nonetheless closer to optimal than the present. There's a book, Freakonomics, which actually doesn't have very much economics, but has some interesting applications of sort of how you do tests of economic predictions. And one of the things that they did was to look at how much time realtors spent searching for houses for customers versus how much time they spent searching houses for themselves. And it turned out that realtors, on average, did a substantially longer search when they were the buyer and thus would get any savings than they did when they got only 80% of the price. And that was sort of an interesting result. I think you'll find it an interesting exercise, and one will be useful if you're ever actually advising people on these things, to say for any contractual situation, if I had a blank sheet, how would I like to structure the incentives? And you can then say, well, what are the problems with that? Well, this is a brilliant idea, but a system where your store clerk has to pay $950,000 for the job in exchange for which she gets a contingency payment that on average is a million, you're probably not going to get many clerks, so that one won't work. But you can still have thought about it, because there might be other variants along those lines. There might be some of your employees would be in a position where they would be willing to work for nothing, let us say, in exchange for a percentage, or even for less than nothing, in the cases where you buy the position. Actually, it occurs to me that there's a historically fairly interesting case of that, and that's commissions in the British Army prior to the last 100 years or so. That if you wanted to be a lieutenant in the British Army, you bought your commission. And you then presumably got paid by some combination of salary, money stolen from the soldiers underneath you, in what you were supposed to be spending on their food and stuff, and loot and so forth. Yeah?
And Romans would also pay for tax collection. So you bid on tax collection.
That's right. That's another good example. That's right. Tax farming, not just the Romans, it's a not uncommon system for collecting taxes, is that we say, all right, somebody is going to have the right to collect the taxes from that province, from this province this year. Who will bid the highest amount? You get to keep the money. All right. So you're right. That hadn't occurred to me. That's a very clear version of that. Can you think of any disadvantage to that system? I mean, it's a rather elegant way of solving the problem of how to hire tax collectors.
Well, isn't that pump people for as much as they can, even if it's unfair? So they may tax more than you have the right to do this, but if they're the only authority, especially back then.
Why is this a problem from the standpoint of the employer, who is the emperor?
People become unhappy about how much they're paying. They say taxes are too high, or they think that, it just causes unrest, especially.
It might cause unrest. It might also cause less tax revenue next year. Right, if the result of these high taxes is that businesses close down and people conceal their wealth and stuff like that, then he makes a killing for 1 year, and then when you try to get a tax farmer for next year, the guy says they won't bid you very much because look what condition he's left the province in. But nonetheless, it's an interesting example, one I should have thought of. All right, another alternative. So first alternative is output based. And lots of contracts, people try to do that. Suppose they tried to give me an output-based contract. That's an interesting question. How would they do it? What would be output for all? That's part of the problem, of course, is that so often output is hard to measure. Let's take an easier case. How about the bar prep classes? With a bar prep class, do you usually have one instructor or multiple instructors? Anybody know? They haven't gotten to that yet. Suppose you had a bar prep class with one instructor. The firm could then pay the instructor a fixed amount per student who passed the bar on the grounds that their reputation will depend on getting students past the bar. All right, so second possibility is an input-based contract, where instead of measuring your output, they measure the input you put in, and that's the sort of the standard hourly wage or salary kind of system. That's billable hours for lawyers. And that gives you an incentive on putting in input, but many of the dimensions of input aren't easily measurable. We can't tell how hard you worked. Often we can't. And that's the limitation of the input measure. And finally, the fixed fee contract, which is where we say, here is $300, fix my table. And that's one where the contract really gives the guy who you contracted with, as stated, no incentive to do anything. You can hand my table back and say, look, I've wiped off the dust. And one way of solving that is to say it's a fixed fee, but it's conditional on X, Y, and Z, on some measurable. It's not proportional to the measurable, but unless you show up in court to defend me, you're not going to get paid. Unless the surface of the table has been refinished, you're not going to get paid, and so forth. And similarly, you could say, well, it's a fixed fee, but the understanding is that for that fee, you will do X, Y, and Z. But in practice, I would think the fixed fee contract is going to tend to be most common where the main incentive is reputation, where you're saying it's not that your payment depends on how good a job you do, it's that your next payment depends on how good a job you do, whether people think you've done well for me. All right. So we have three alternatives and mixes of them. We have output-based rewards, we have input-based rewards, and we have fixed sums. And we can have combinations. For example, the one that I was suggesting that seems so bizarre, which is the one where I pay you a fixed sum of minus $10,000 to take my law case, and you then collect anything you get out of it. Risk bearing. How does risk bearing fit with these different things? Performance-based, the risk is borne largely by the agent, because if you say you're on a contingency fee, in the pure contingency fee case, not only do you only get paid if you win the case, but you're paying for your you're putting in your own time, you're also hiring experts and detectives and whoever else you need, so therefore, if you lose the case, you not only get zero, you in effect get much less than zero, but if you win the case, you do very well. All right? And in that case, the principal, of course, has the risk that you'll lose the case, but if you lose the case, you don't have anything because he hasn't paid you anything, he hasn't paid for any experts, so it's zero or win rather than minus or win. Input-based, the principal is, of course, bearing the risk of the... Of course, actually, the performance-based, he isn't even bearing all of the risk of the outcome because some of the outcome benefit is going to go to you, right? So if in the full version, in my full version, where you pay me $10,000 to take over the case and then you collect the damages, in that one, I, the client, am bearing no risk at all. I've got a fixed payment. You're bearing all of it. In the more realistic case, where you don't pay me anything but you collect half the damages, now my risk is from zero to getting half the damages. Your risk is from minus something to getting half the damages. And the fixed fee, the principal is bearing all of the risk of the outcome, but the agent is bearing all of the risk of the costs. If it turns out the guy fixing my table has to spend much longer than he thought because of something he hadn't observed about the table, that's going to be his cost. Now, I exaggerate a little bit because, in fact, I ended up bearing the risk of the sliders having to be replaced, but that was only because I didn't push him on the fact that he'd agreed to fix it. Basically, I figured that it wasn't a very large cost. He didn't know where to find them. I could find those parts, and then he could put them in for me. But basically, if you think about risk bearing, the performance-based gives you a good incentive in terms of performing because you're going to get a good deal of the reward, but you are then taking over the risk. The input-based, you're shifting all of it. You're being paid for your inputs, so you know what you're going to get. And it's the principal who's now taking the risk. And the fixed fee, the principal is taking the risk of whether he wins, and you're taking the risk of how much you have to spend trying to do it. So it's a fairly neat division. Let's now consider the case that you've looked at, where the Attorney General for the state is trying to consider the possibility of suing somebody or other for lots of money, tobacco companies maybe. Can somebody explain to me why didn't the states get ruled out of court on the tobacco companies on the grounds of unclean hands, since they made much more money from the tobacco sales than the tobacco companies did? Anybody? No.
The state can do whatever they want.
I assume this was in federal court, though. In federal court, states can't do whatever they want. However, your office is not on a scale to handle a tort suit for hundreds of millions of dollars. So you're going to find an outside firm to do it. Do states do that, by the way? Do you know? Do states, in fact, subcontract? As the one case in which, in a sense, I know they do it, is if you think about indigent defense, where the state hires private attorneys, depending on the state, but in some states, to defend indigents.
Sometimes it has special prosecutors for the state.
Huh.
I know they do it in the federal system. I don't know the OC, for instance.
And the special prosecutor is not himself an employee in any ordinary sense.
Not necessarily. Not so just be a private officer.
He's a contractor.
And, he has connection. He's good enough to...
Yeah. Experience. Right. So that's what you want to do. And the problem, of course, is that there's a large risk, both directions. If it wins, you can make lots of money, but if the courts laugh you out of, if you get laughed out of court, the way I think the people trying to duplicate the tobacco wins with guns, gun companies did, then you spent money on litigation and got nothing. Right? And furthermore, they are worried about political fallout. Suppose it turns out that they spend $50 million on this firm. Firm loses. Not only do they not get the money, not only have they lost $50 million, but now the party out of power in the state will say, look, this was obviously a corrupt deal by which they were paying off their friends in this company. They're planning to get jobs with that law firm when they get out. Vote the villains out. So you can see the problem. So you are to advise your department head on the compensation scheme. Anybody want to start describing some of the possible ways, possible deals you could make with the litigation firm? How about starting with you, since you're at this end?
Sorry, say it
again. What possible deals could you make? You're advising the Attorney General on what deal to offer to a litigation firm. What are some of the possible deals you might consider? Let's write them up as you
list them.
What terms might you offer?
Well, you can do the tax farming situation where you get whatever.
So one of them is
they get everything. They have to pay for the contract.
Right. That's it. First, I got to find one of these. Right. So option one. Agent collects all, pays for right to do so. Let's just start with that just for a moment. How do you figure out how much the agent ought to pay for the right to collect it all? The agents compete. You auction it off. All right. Yeah, but it does have the attractive feature in a sense that one of the important variables you have a chance of getting determined just for what offers different people make you. So let's add to this auction. All right. What's another way you could do it? Yep.
Contingency.
Well, this is a very extreme contingency. What's your contingency?
They pay nothing, but collect a percentage of the settlement.
Yes, with percent less than 100%. Very common arrangement. All right, what's another alternative?
Even flat fee and then bonus for percentage.
Flat
things.
Fee, possibly bonus. Who pays expenses? It's really a flat fee. Right, so.
Well, let's assume the state pays the expenses.
Well, that's not a flat fee anymore. That's an input.
Yeah,
so let's take flat fee.
Situation.
Let me take flat fee as three, and then what's our fourth version?
So expenses.
Fourth version is input. State pays per hour plus other costs. Maybe I should start doing this stuff on the computer too, given that the computer has legible handwriting and I don't. But all right, so state pays per hour plus other costs. So those are some possibilities. And now, what are the advantages and disadvantages of each of those? Let's start at the top. That's my favorite system. I think it's a very elegant solution.
Would it be out of the question to say that you could just hire more attorneys? Let's say some of these people work for these firms. Imagine if the fee for one of these attorneys to be hired as a state attorney would be equal to the percentage.
So you're saying another possibility is to do it in-house.
Yeah.
do it in-house. Yeah, that certainly is a possibility, but I don't think, since we're interested in the principal-agent things, that really gets into a somewhat different issue where the agent is the individual attorney, not the firm. So let's, for a moment, let's limit it at least, unless we have extra time, maybe we consider that, but yeah.
With the first one, you take on a considerable amount of risk because you're expected to cover your own expenses during the trial, and then on top of that, you've already paid whatever the option fee.
So the first one, the firm has huge risk. All right. Can you think of any other? So you might find that firms weren't willing to bid very much on the grounds that they were afraid of that. Can you think of any other disadvantages from your standpoint as you're advising your employers, the Attorney General? Any other problems?
Well, the Attorney General is out what could be potentially a huge settlement.
The attorney
goes entirely to, if the settlement is a lot greater than the fees collected for the agent to pursue the case.
That is to say, one risk for the Attorney General, there are in fact risks in both directions, right? The Attorney General, if it turns out that they got paid $100,000 by the law firm and the law firm collected $3 million, all right, that's going to look really bad because it obviously sold out to them. So, AGPR risk, if big win. On the other hand, if there's a loss, the Attorney General may be unpopular with the law firm, but he got $100,000 for the citizens of the state, and we've just seen that we didn't really have a case. So, yeah, so that's so one problem. There is the PR risk. Any other disadvantages? How about, all right, are there any, I'm not sure I see anything else with one, but any of you see other things you ought to include in one on either? There's the pro is pretty obvious, namely that the pro is that the firm now has the full incentive to spend money trying to win the case, right?
Isn't it also that the Attorney General kind of wants to reform the healthcare industry for people, and that the law firms want to make money, so they may not like have your interests fully aligned when it comes to settlement?
That is very good. This is actually a fairly general problem. You're right, and I should have considered it. So that's risk, but the other potential problem is non-pecuniary objectives. And they think about it that way. And I could imagine that in a number of different ways. One, what I think you're suggesting is the possibility of settlement terms other than cash payment. So that you can imagine that perhaps the best term is not we will pay damages of X, but we will agree to change what we're doing in the future in a certain way. And the law firm has no incentive to aim for that at all, so they're going to ignore it. Let's consider a different case, which I think I actually have on a later slide, but which is really relevant here. Does the law firm care whether or not the defendant is guilty? So you could imagine a case, suppose there are multiple defendants, and suppose one of the defendants is in fact perfectly innocent, has been providing health care services in a good way, but for some reason it's easy to make them look bad. They're foreknown, let us say. Or they were involved in a particular case that got a lot of publicity where they really did nothing wrong, but the newspaper made them look wrong. You think of a variety of things like that. Now you might say the law firm sees them as a good deep pockets target, but from the standpoint of the state as a whole, what does that mean? We're going to drive out of the state the people who do a good job and keep in the state people doing a bad job. Now, of course, it's a little unclear here because we've got a second layer of principal-agent problems between the Attorney General and the citizens of the state. So it might be that the Attorney General would say, well, look, I'm not planning to go to any of those hospitals anyway. If this hospital has a bad public reputation because they're owned by Saudis or because somebody died in their waiting room and the newspapers made a big fuss over it, great, let's get them. And the villagers will say how wonderful I am. And it's true, they're innocent, but why should I care about that? And of course, that's also an issue, maybe in some sense an even stronger issue if you think about criminal cases, that one of the things you would like to have and that's extraordinarily hard to get is some system of incentives in which it pays prosecutors to convict guilty people but not innocent people. All right? It's not a trivial problem. If you think about going away from this case, it's sort of an interesting problem. You're setting up a legal system with any possible arrangement you like. And there have been lots and lots of historical legal systems. How do you make the people who are deciding who to prosecute and how hard to prosecute, and the police and prosecutors basically, how do you make them care whether or not the person they get is guilty? As opposed to whether they can convict him. Yep?
Well, maybe if they take a case to trial and the defendant, or the jury finds the defendant not guilty, they get like a deduction in pay or something like that.
There is, in fact, a real world example of this from one of the world's most famous societies, namely Periclean Athens. That in the classical Athenian legal system, almost all prosecution was private. That basically you had what we would have think of as a crime. The payment, the punishment was usually a large fine. And a private citizen, any adult male Athenian citizen, was the one who made the case. All right? They had big juries, a couple of hundred people in a jury. If he got fewer than 30% of the jury to vote for conviction, the prosecutor was fined. Now, it's not perfect, because that still depends on your jury system being reliable, right? But it at least, to the extent the jury system is somewhat reliable, to the extent that prosecuting innocent people, you're more likely to lose. It gives some incentive. Yeah?
Well, at that point, it also seems a problem that the prosecutor might want to play dirty or do like his utmost once he starts the process, never stop.
Yes.
He can't back out of that.
That's right, and that's a problem with any. Similarly, it seems to me that as a matter of justice, if you arrest an innocent person, hold him in jail for 6 months, and make him spend $50,000 on his defense, you ought to owe him $50,000 plus another $50,000 of damages. But if you actually have that legal rule, then, as you say, the whoever you're trying to get incentives to is going to have a very strong incentive to conceal evidence, to engage in perjury, to do all sorts of nasty things to get people convicted.
You can also have the prosecuting person respond. Yeah, so he has to pay a percentage of that money for the person's defense or something like that. Yeah. So it's like, oh, well, you're not going to get any bonus this year. You know what I'm saying? Just be careful. Make sure you don't screw
up. But there is, in my opinion, at least one system, not our system, which to some extent does it. And that's a system where the motive for prosecution is private deterrence. All right? So I'm actually thinking of a real-world case. This time it's 18th century England. 18th century England, in paper, they had our legal system. That is to say, they had tort law and criminal law. They did not have police or prosecutors. So if you were the victim of a crime, in practice it was up to you or your agents to find the stolen property, prove it in court, and so forth. And, in fact, part of the way they did that was that people would join prosecution associations, where a prosecution association is a bunch of people in one town, each of whom pays an annual fee, which fee will then go to pay the expenses of prosecuting anybody who commits a felony against them. And the names of the members of the association are published in the newspaper for the felons to read. So it's a way of pre-committing to prosecution in order to deter felonies. It's making deterrence a private rather than a public good.
Insurance.
It isn't insurance. It looks like insurance. But the insurance, you wouldn't have to publish a list of names. The critical point is that you want, once the felony has occurred, it probably doesn't pay you to prosecute it. Because he's not going to pay you any damages. It's not a tort system. You're going to bear the cost of prosecution. But you'd like people to know that if they commit a felony against you, they will be prosecuted. So you want to pre-commit, and you do that by joining the association. But the association, what the association cares about, is not just can it convict a jury that this guy was guilty. It also cares can it convict the criminals this guy was guilty. Because if the result of my robbing you is that he gets convicted of the robbery, that's no reason for me not to rob you. And if your objective is to deter robberies, that's not very satisfactory. So private deterrence, if we assume the criminals are better informed about guilt than the jury is, then private deterrence is the one system I know about where the person making the decision cares whether the guy he's prosecuting is guilty or not. Does that make sense or not?
It does. Yeah, at the same time, though, it still happens in our system as well, because they have, people aren't going to, it's the same thing. They have to believe, you know, the same situation occurs. I rob you, somebody else gets charged with it. I have to believe that I'm going to get caught, right? That's the same idea.
Except, I understand, but sure, if it were true that the income of the people running our prosecuting system depended on deterring crime, then you'd be perfectly right. But in fact, if our legal system fails to deter crime, the result is not that the Attorney General is worse off, it's not that the governor is worse off, probably the chief of police is better off because the higher crime rate will get public pressure to spend more money on the police. Right? So in the system I'm describing, the deterrence is a private good and the private people involved want to produce it. Deterrence as a public good has the usual problem of how do you make it in the interest of the state to act in the interest of the citizens. So, in any case, it's a digression, but it occurred to me as an interesting digression because it's an important real-world problem, given that pretty clearly, I think it's pretty clear that a fair number of prosecutors don't much care whether the guy is guilty as long as they can convict him. I think there's reason to believe that. I guess, in a sense, the notorious case is the degree to which prosecutors resist attempts to get DNA testing after the fact. So it's reasonably clear that many prosecutors would rather have an innocent man remain in jail than have it discovered that they convicted an innocent man. I think the fact that you're resistant to DNA testing is pretty strong evidence of that, at least. But anyway, so going back to this one, though, but we do want to worry in general about the dimensions of the objective, and that the first contract assumes the only objective is to get as much money as possible out of the defendants. That might be the only objective, but another objective might be either to get non-monetary settlements out of the defendants or to get the right people punished in order to deter bad behavior in the future. Those are both possibilities that we might want to think about. All right, so what about the second contract? The second contract is a sort of a standard contingency contract. Half the money, let us say, goes to the law firm, half the money goes to the state, and the law firm does not get reimbursed for its hours or other expenses.
Box this illegible stuff and put it there. How about for this one? Is there... What are the cons?
What are the disadvantages of this contract? Yeah.
The agent's still taking on all the risk of the expenses.
If the agent is taking on the risk of the expenses and some of the risk of the outcome. On the other hand, the state now is not taking on that risk, as it wasn't in the first one.
Well, they do, because they have, if it's contingency, then less than 100%.
They have a risk of outcome, but not of costs.
Correct.
Right. Yes, exactly. So, are there any other disadvantages to this one? How do the incentives look? Yep.
Well, the principal doesn't have to pay anything up front.
The principal does not have to pay anything up front. Yeah, I'm not sure if that's an advantage or disadvantage from our standpoint. But in terms of sort of maximizing the total benefit to the two parties of the contract, which in a sense is our bottom line, yeah.
Are they bidding on the contingency percentage? Because then a matter of how do you select which firm to do it.
That is one.
So if they bid, then they select.
You're right. So you might want to think about that, but that's going to be a little bit tricky, because notice that with the contingency contract, they don't have the full incentive to spend money to win the case. They're only getting 50 cents for every dollar that they gain. And therefore, the firm that wins the bidding is going to be the firm that's willing to take the lowest percentage. Right, but that maybe they're willing to take the lowest percentage because they're not planning to spend very much, and are figuring that if they spend not very much, then even 10% of the chance of winning it without a lot of effort. So it's going to be a little tricky figuring out how to get the best deal. Putting it differently, the return to the state is not just the percentage; it's the percentage times the chance of winning. and the firms can't bid a chance of winning.
Then bidding, they're saying, well, if I'm bidding this low, it's because I know cheaper experts or my
It might be. All I'm saying is that in the first case, all the state cared about was the amount that they got paid. And therefore, the bidding conveyed all that information. In this one, they care not only about the percentage, but also the chance of winning, and the bidding only tells them the first. So it's not full. But the other problem is that the incentive of the agent is now less than full, that the agent has only 50% incentive, so to speak. So the agent won't hire the expert unless they think that the benefit from the expert is at least twice his cost. Right? So that's a problem. Not. What about, should we be worried, what should the Attorney General be worried about anything? He's worried about PR. What could go wrong?
It's a fixed percentage. He has to select somebody.
He has to select somebody. What could go wrong now? How could this case end up with him looking like mud and not getting reelected, or his patriots not getting reelected?
I think it's a huge reward.
Right. If it turns out that they get a huge reward and people say, well, yeah, it's very nice that the state ended up with $5 million, but those guys ended up with $5 million of our money, too. I mean, we were the ones who were hurt. They weren't hurt. Yeah, they did a little work for it, but not nearly $5 million worth of work. Right, so that you're going to have to worry that if the big reward, again, big win PR problems. Or putting it differently, if it's a big win, somebody's going to say, why couldn't you find a company that would do it for 25% instead of 50%? Look, 25%, they would still have gotten millions of dollars. All right, how about flat fee with or without a bonus for winning? Now what are the problems?
The bonus is the only incentive.
That in that one, if it's a flat fee, putting aside the bonus, why should they do any work at all or do anything more than whatever minimal work they've contracted to do? Right, and if you expect that there are going to be many such cases coming up, maybe they have strong reputational incentives to do it. But short of that, so instead there's an incentive problem. And the bonus might help deal with that, depending on how you structure the bonus. At that point, you're really making it partly contingency, partly not. Also, were you thinking of the bonus being a fixed or a percentage bonus?
It could be
either. Well, if it's a fixed bonus for winning, then they have an incentive not to ask for large amounts, because then they're more likely to get it. And also, of course, you're going to have settlement. Then, in a sense, any fixed bonus system gives them an incentive to do just enough to get the bonus, but not to do more than that.
Well, also excluding reputation.
Excluding reputation, of course. Sure. All of these things, reputation is going to help improve their incentives. That's true. And how about the what's the AG afraid of this time? What's going to give him a PR nightmare?
Small reward?
If they end up getting little money, they've paid lots of money to this law firm. Look how you've been wasting our money. They lost, right? Well, you paid the money, they didn't even win. You could have done better than that, right? So there are going to be some potential PR problems there too. All right, let's see. This is running through incentive, risks, and political. I didn't go through risk on all of these, but the flat fee, the law firm has the risk of costs, and the AG has the risks of outcomes, basically. And the contingent fee, in the extreme version, all of the risk is with the agent. And 50% contingency we've, I think, discussed already. All right. No financial incentive for lawyers to win. Reputational incentive. How well can the office monitor them to make sure they're doing job? How can you control how hard they try by contract? No risk on payment for the law firm, but they bear all the risks of costs. Who is more risk averse? Political, no risk of stories on huge fee payment, but if the case feels the agency looks bad. Cost plus, going through this a little quickly because we're running out of time. They have an incentive to spend too much time if the rate is too high, too little if the rate is low. How well can you verify the hours actually worked? Did they assign their crack person, or did they assign to look at a technical issue, someone with no technical expertise who happened to be at loose ends because the case he was working on had settled or something? And again, can you control that stuff by contracts? Risk, revenue risk is borne by the state, and most of the cost risk, if it's on cost plus. Political risk of huge payments for no return. Contingent fee, 100% negative fixed, anything less than 100% incentive perfect, we've been through that. And no incentive for any relief other than a damage payment, the risk shared between firm and state, and a large amounts to the lawyers if the suit is successful might be embarrassing. And then what is the max demand? The law firm still wants to win. Does the state still want to win? That's not so clear. Coffee house manager employment contract. That's one that's in the book. So if it's performance-based, how ought we to do a performance-based one if he's managing a coffee house? We've got a firm with 50 coffee houses. Do we base his return on how much money the firm made this year? Good, bad? Got a better way of doing it?
How much his house made.
How much his house made, because he's going to make a very small contribution to the whole firm. So we're going to want to base it on his coffee house. That's an argument against stock options, because stock options are going to reflect the performance of the firm as a whole. Input-based. We could have him, you know, punch a time clock, though I think managers, my guess is managers usually don't punch time clocks. But a lot of it is going to be very hard to measure. First, we don't want to just know about hours. We want to know when he was about to lose his temper with the employee he really needed. Did he suppress that, or did he say, boy, I enjoy reaming this guy out, and if we lose him, tough luck. You can think of an awful lot of decisions a manager is making where it's not just does he spend time, but basically how hard does he try to do the best possible job. I suspect as a customer of many firms that there's a sort of an invisible technology of making a firm a happy place to work, which I don't understand very well, which is one of the really key variables as to the success of firms. I mean, there are places where you go in, and it's clear that the employees like each other, they like the customers, they're having fun, as it were. And I think those work a whole lot better. And even the quantitative, you would have the problem, how would you measure it, how do you know he's really, maybe he punches the time clock and then goes out for drinks somewhere. And the people in a best position to monitor are all working for him and may very well be in his pocket, so to speak. And the fixed fee, flat salary, then has the usual problems. All right. Joint undertakings, those include partnerships such as a law firm, joint projects by two firms. This is a real case that it used to be that Apple didn't use Intel chips. They switched as the final result of all of this story that I'm telling, but I first wrote the story before that. And what happened was that IBM said, we're going to be able to make these new CPUs using a 60-nanometer process, making smaller, faster, less heat-producing chips than before, and those will be in the series of chips, the PowerPC chips that you're using. And so Apple made their plans. Apple announced they were going to have a 3 gigahertz desktop. Do they have a 3 gigahertz desktop yet? I think they may now with the latest Intel chips. Yes? Yeah, the fastest one is now up to 3. But this was like 3 years ago or something. And then Steve Jobs had to eat a lot of crow because he didn't have it. And apparently what was happening was that IBM was having huge failure rates when they tried to make the chips that small. And how could a contract deal with it? Well, IBM controls both how hard they try to make the chips come out on schedule, and they have better information. Not good enough information. It turned out everybody, in fact, had trouble scaling down. They had new difficulties. Should IBM be liable for the losses? Well, some of the losses depend on what Steve promises as well as on what IBM delivers. And so you can, you know, think of some of the obvious problems. We're running out of time anyway. And I don't think I'm going to do these things. I may do some of this stuff Thursday, but we're out of time now. All right. You can read, if you want to read, the PowerPoints will be up probably tonight. No, actually they won't. They'll be up next, at the end of the week. I've been doing it. So, but it's in the book anyway, most of the stuff today, except for what isn't. Find myself slowing down this late in the afternoon.
I got a question for you.
Yes.
So on this AG problem,
yes,
wouldn't like the optimal solution here be something like the Attorney General putting making it incentive based, but based on particular events, because they know as lawyers exactly what they want. They can foresee the problems. They just can't handle doing a case this big. So maybe Congress is saying, okay, if you get past this stage, we give you this, et cetera. You
know, that's an interesting different possibility.
Because then the risk is on the appropriate party for each stage, because they can cancel when they want if they don't get the right outcome on a certain level. And they're only paying for what they want.
So what you want to do in a certain, it's not quite, it's somewhere between performance and input in a sense, but that is because each performance is the input to the next step, as it were. So how would you actually structure that? You're going to have that they get paid for not getting dismissed at whatever the initial
right stage. So you get past this portion of discovery, you get these types of things in, because assuming they actually know what they're looking for, then they should be able to in this case. So assuming you get these experts to be able to testify on our behalf, you get this much money. If not, you get this much or you don't, or something like that.
Is the Attorney General going to know who the experts are they need?
Well, I'm guessing they probably...
They've only got four lawyers, and those lawyers are spending most of their time doing other things.
Right, but this would give them the research. They would do the research beforehand, right, before they form the contract with the outside
counsel. Yeah, so there's a certain sense in which you're now dividing. You're now subcontracting only part of the job.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. I don't have a clear enough idea of how well you could specify. I mean, in the IBM case, you could imagine saying, part of the deal is that you agree that you will have samples that perform in this way by such and such a month.
Right.
So, in your version, does the return depend at all on how much actual damages they get?
I mean, you want to do that, I guess, at a certain level, right? I mean, you want to include that kind of bonus also.
So then what's the advantage?
Because paying them reaching particular stages, if in any case, they're not going to get paid.
Well, all the problems are going to be here on the board. What I was thinking was they all have problems in terms of how much money might be settled for, right? Mm-hmm. And here you basically control the entire step of the way.